this is where I would say we started to develop our ethic around how we choose houses, and then especially once we've chosen one, how we were going to make them both financially and in terms of family beneficial to our long-term picture.
Run your home and your dough like a biblical boss.
Our house is currently for sale.
Oh!
And I'll tell you what, it's not going to be for sale in 2 days, barring some sort of otherworldly miracle. We will be pulling it off the market and not selling it for several years. So,
wow.
That's probably
okay. Well, you've piqued my interest. I'm gonna give you some line and just let you run with it.
We'll get to that at the end of this episode. We're not going to talk about what's going on right now in my house right now, but we are going to talk about, is your house an investment? I feel like this is a question that people ask all the time. Should I consider my house an investment? It's the most expensive thing I've ever bought. It grows in value over time. It seems like an investment to me, but I also kind of want like a newly renovated kitchen. Would that be an investment or would that be consumption? Should I extend myself as hard as possible to buy the biggest, nicest house I can afford? Or should I go like super conservative? I want to talk about your house and the decisions to do it, but this is more story time with Mark and Steve. We're not going to go through principles so much today. I think we'll touch on them as we go. I'm going to spin some yarn telling you the story of houses that I have bought, and we have the benefit of hindsight on a lot of those. Some of them I have sold. And I think we're going to get to a lot of the questions people have when they're thinking about housing, just because my family has been through a whole bunch of different things. We've had wins and losses on the housing front. And I want to talk about how we think about spending money on houses.
I was just seeing that year over year, right now in the state of Ohio, in our metros in Ohio, there are places like Sandusky and Shaker Heights where there has been a surge between 67 and 80% in home prices year over year. So there, the stock of homes available is very low, and the amount of people wanting to buy a house is very high, and the average house price is so high right now. So the threshold for getting into, if you've never owned a house before and you want to get into owning a house, the signs all say, stay away. But if you are trying to capture equity that you've built over time, well, that's a great time to sell, right?
House prices have gotten bananas gorilla. And let me tell you some stories because it'll start illustrating what we're talking about.
Go on.
I remember a time as a 21-year-old. When I was sitting in Washington, D.C., and I had just gotten my first job, I had just graduated from college. So, no, I was 22. I was 22. I had a job, but I had that job for like 6 weeks. And I was looking around going, man, in Washington, D.C., the suburbs here, it costs $600,000 to buy an absolute trash heap of a house. And you really have to spend $1 million if you want something nice. And this was in 2005. So I was thinking there's other markets in the country, kind of thinking about Ohio, where I think I'll probably not live in Washington, D.C. for that long. We were there because my wife was going to school. Maybe I want to go ahead and snag some real estate somewhere else where I would envision myself living in the future. Get in before this housing explosion happens everywhere in the country that I was seeing in Washington, D.C. And I'll kind of hedge my exposure to housing risk. So I bought my first house, not as a place I was going to live, but in the city of Austin, Texas, when I was 22 years old. And I bought a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house that was 1,800 square feet. What do you think that ran me in Austin, Texas, about a mile and a half from the Dell campus, so a growing part of North Austin. Not quite as hipster trendy as South Austin, but, you know, still a decent neighborhood. What do you think that cost to buy that house?
I think it costs you $225,000.
It cost me $130,000 to buy that house.
Oh, baby! Do you still own that house?
The cool thing is, when I bought it, the realtor was like, this house has some great long-term tenants already in it that are paying two times the mortgage in monthly rent. So I thought, wins.
Wow.
I'm going to make money. I'm going to have the house. If I need to move into it someday, there it is.
What's not to learn?
And I'll never forget calling my new tenants after this deal had closed. And I have changed their names for their own protection. But let's say on the lease, I had Raymond the renter. And I remember calling and a lady picked up the phone and said hello. And I said, hi, this is the new landlord. I'm just calling to introduce myself. Could I talk to Raymond? Raymond's in jail. What?
Dang it. That is hard news to receive. That was unfortunate news for you to hear on the first day that you're trying to extend an olive branch to your long-term tenants.
Great long-term tenants were not great as advertised. It turns out that Raymond went in and out of jail various times during his time with me and our relationship a landlord-tenant. And I don't remember exactly what the rent was. I think it was like $1,300 a month or something. But there was a $50 per day late fee if you didn't pay it on time. And I remember this family because they would pay their rent a month late all the time. And it would just stack up and stack up. And I'm like, guys, you owe me $2,200 now.
From last month.
Every time I would say, guys, here's the deal. I am not trying to put your family backwards in the world. If you stay in this house, you have to pay me every dollar that our agreement says you will pay me. However, if you'll just move out and move to a home you can afford, I'll forgive it all.
We'll call it a day and move on with our lives.
Yeah, I made this offer every time. And it never was taken up. There was always some way, and I think given Raymond's history with the law, we might not want to even know how, but he would come up
Raymond.
With the cash. Until one day he finally said, you're right, we're moving out. Raymond left. Raymond stole all the appliances in the home when he moved out.
Raymond is continuing. He's continuing some of these awful multi-generational patterns that he brought into the household. And he's continuing them. And he's bringing new problems into your generations by taking, for instance, the range.
The range and the refrigerator, all these things.
Oh, Raymond.
I got a call from the sheriff after I reported this, and he said, I have good news and bad news, Mr. Parrott. The good news is we found Raymond. The bad news is I don't think you're getting your appliances back because he's in jail.
We found him in jail. That's where we located him.
But Raymond moved out. Professor Bob was my next tenant. The only story I have about Professor Bob is getting a phone call one day. And he was kind of a nerdy academic and great, always paid on time, etc. But Professor Bob called me one day and he said, Mark, I need to tell you, the downstairs toilet and bathroom have flooded. And I said, that's terrible. Let me get a plumber out there. When did it start? Well, there's been water, just about 6 inches of water on the whole first floor for about 4 days. And I said, Professor Bob, this is really bad news because our contract says you are to alert me of these types of problems immediately. Why have you been canoeing through the first floor to get up to your bedroom? So
I'm sorry. It made a fascinating study of bacteria life, and I was using it for some experimentation. I'm very sorry.
And the only reason I'm telling this is because sometimes I think landlordship, A, it gets glorified as like it's always a winning game because there's a lot of people out there who have become landlords, say in 2012. And Stephen, what you just talked about in Ohio is house prices have gone bananas and they're just going, I bought a house. It's worth twice as much now. I'm getting paid three times the rent. Times are good. The way to multi-generational wealth is through rental homes. And I just want to provide this tale to say, sometimes landlording is not a financial winner in the short or even the medium term. I bought that house in 2005. I sold it in 2014 for $120,000. It was a loser deal from start to finish. Now, in the middle of that was the financial collapse of 2008. So had I stuck my money in the stock market, I might have done similarly. I mean, I made some money, I lost some money. It wasn't a disaster. But I just wanted to throw that out there because sometimes there's a mythology around the ownership of real estate. And I just tell people, it can be great. I am not anti-rental home ownership. But I did develop some rules from that experiment, like don't own rental properties from a distance unless you have a rock solid network of people in place to help you take care of them and put eyes on them regularly. And spend a lot of time vetting your potential renters because you don't really need a Raymond in your life, especially when you're trying to grow a family and things like that. So I told you that story, but most people that are listening to this are primarily interested in their primary residence. So I did, once DC ended, moved to Utah, and we felt like kids in a candy store because we moved from this place where, like I said, $600,000 bought you a teardown to a place where you could buy a house for under $200,000 that was nice to live in. And we were just like, wow, this is crazy. We didn't make much money. You know, I had a pretty solid job in the financial services world. My wife was a medical resident, which they don't pay you jack for that work. And so we didn't make a ton of money, but we could afford to buy a single family home. And we looked around and looked around and finally chose one. And this is where I would say we started to develop our ethic around how we choose houses. And then especially once we've chosen one, how we were going to make them both financially and in terms of family beneficial to our long-term picture.
Okay. Now, you're about to tell people some secret sauce. So if you have been, I don't know, your eyes are wandering around the road, you're reading menus while you're listening to this, I would like to encourage you to start paying attention because Mark is about to give you some very helpful tips when it comes to making home ownership a profitable enterprise. Tell us this story.
House number one, it was relatively speaking, now if you're listening to this from Manhattan, you're going to go, that is a palace. But relatively speaking, we bought a smaller house. I think it was a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house. And it was 100 years old. And so one thing that you find out quick when you buy an old home is there's a lot of issues. Get the inspection report for a 100-year-old house and you should buckle your seatbelt because if you're a first-time home buyer, you're going to think, well, this thing is just, we can't buy it. But really, every old house has thousands of potential things you could do to fix it. The good news with a small house, and this will come in as we continue down the path, but the good news with a small house is that most of the issues are pretty manageable. This first house we bought, there was foundation issues, and that might scare the living daylights out of somebody, but on a small house, it was like getting somebody with some wood beams to crawl under the house and stabilize the foundation. It took them a day, and I think it cost me $900 back then. So surmountable. Of course, at that time, $900 felt like a lot of money.
Surmountable. People rarely use the word surmountable. Well done, man. Mark.
You might hear it over and over because I'm looking at my notes and I see that word at least three more times.
You've glossed over the price of this house. Were you going to get to that?
Sure. We paid $250,000 for this house. And we were pretty, we were starting out as a family financially. So some of that money I borrowed from a parent, just FYI. I got a loan and I did a couple things right and a couple of things wrong. What okay. I did right is my parent did not offer a below market rate loan. They were charging a full blast current market rate loan. And
can you guess at square footage?
I think that house was 2,100 square feet. It lived a little smaller than that, and I'll talk about that for a second, because the roof, the attic had been converted into living space.
Which is kind of a dodge.
Yeah, you couldn't get closer than, say, 8 feet to the edge of your square footage.
Yeah, that's not right.
Because it was a roof.
I was going to say that we support the idea of borrowing money from trustworthy family members, but I wasn't thinking that it was going to be at market rates. So, okay.
Yeah. So I was paying market rate for a loan from a parent. I did the smart thing of putting all that on paper, loan repayment terms, etc. You should always do that. Even if the loan is 0% interest, you should write it down and sign it. And what I didn't do is send him tax forms every year that said, this is how much profit you made off of me, because I could have also reported that interest as deductible had I done that. And, you know, there were, like I said, there were some issues with this house. The fact that the attic had been converted, they didn't put any insulation in it. So that attic could get up to, say, 107 degrees in the summer. I had to be creative with how to air condition it. I had this giant industrial air conditioner that sat in the corner of the attic. But it was a cool house. Like, people walked in and they went, this is a cool house. And we didn't have a ton of money for renovations. But what we learned how to do on this one is make improvement dollars go a long way, both for value of the house long term, and maybe even more importantly, and I'm going to talk about this in all three houses that I talk about, but we never renovated houses like flippers. We said, we're going to renovate houses in a way that adds value, but really builds the house we want to live in.
That's a very important point. I'm pausing. I'm interrupting you to put stars by that point. Mark said he and his wife used improvement dollars, home improvement dollars, to do two things simultaneously. Make the house more of the house that they wanted in the first place and increase the value of the home. That is very shrewd, and we'll get back to that. Go on.
So on this house, again, relatively cash-strapped, newlywed still-ish family, like a kitchen renovation, I'll talk about doing a real kitchen renovation in the next house, but I spent, I think, $5,000 on this kitchen, and it had IKEA cabinets with this terrible Formica countertop. Well, we didn't have enough money to replace the cabinets and all that, but I could I scraped together $5,000, and I found this, I still dream of it, this awesome, interesting piece of granite that we put onto the existing cabinets, and it totally changed like the look of the whole house. People walked into the kitchen and went, that's the coolest countertop ever. We extended it out so that you could now, instead of just having a kitchen counter, you had like a little seating breakfast bar type thing. And then we spent a little bit of money to put a new dishwasher and a new fridge in there. So it looked nice and kind of modern, I think, in a range too. And in a stroke of the Lord's provision, the new dishwasher we bought from Whirlpool. At the time, one of my consulting clients was Whirlpool, and so I got cost on all these appliances. After they sold me this dishwasher at a ridiculously low price through their insider program, it broke and it flooded my house. And Whirlpool called us and they said, we feel bad about this. New hardwoods for the whole house. And so we got free new floors on this house due to a faulty dishwasher. There was another improvement here. I learned that upstairs attic space, that was like the master bedroom. And so there was a bed on one side, there was a bathroom on the other. But there was, I don't know if you've ever experienced it, there was kind of a pony wall, like a wall separating the bathroom from the bedroom, but no door. And I learned at that time in my life that I am not comfortable pooping in an open air environment.
I think at some point in our lives, we all learn that. So I think it was probably time for you to learn that. So that's okay.
So did I fret about this? No, I built a small addition to that wall and installed a door. And now we have a separate bathroom and bedroom, and very inexpensive. I think I spent $450 to make all that happen or something. Again, when I talk about prices, I'm talking about prices back then. Things have changed. I think added a lot of value to the house to have a separate bathroom and bedroom. So we did little things like that. What else did I want to say? Oh, when we bought this house, the mortgage rate was 7.85%. That was our first mortgage rate. So if you're shopping for a house right now and going, rates are so high, they're 7%, or I actually think as of today, rates are about 6% on a 30-year mortgage. They've been a lot higher. You've heard our parents probably talk about the time in the 80s when rates were in the teens. But our rate was 7.85%, and I was able to refinance that after not very long, down to 5.5%. So, as they say, marry the house, date the rate. I don't know if that's always good advice, but if mortgage rates are kind of temporarily high, it's okay to think, well, these are probably coming down. So, keep in mind that mortgage rates are not forever, especially if they're going through a period of being higher.
If you don't know this, it might be a first-time homeowner, and you're trying to ask yourself, well, I could refinance right now because we've been paying faithfully on our principal. Our home's value has gone up. Probably if you're looking to refinance right now, you think rates have gone up since we got into our house. So is it smart to refi or not? Just a little rule of thumb in the mortgage world. I used to be a mortgage broker and used to do these regularly. And the rule of thumb is if you can lower your interest rate by 2%, then it's a good move to refi because it costs some money. It costs about $1,500 on average to refi, you know, a $250,000 house. So, you are going to be spending some money to do a refinance. When is it the right move? Just as a rule of thumb, you want to lower your rate by 2%. And your story is that you lowered it by 2.375, I think, something around there. And so that was a good refi. So just to throw that in as a principle for people, because we want you to make the most of your home owning dollars. All right. Yeah. So would you summarize how much you think you invested in that first house?
We were in it for about about $275,000.
Okay, so you think you spent $25,000 on it in total while you lived
probably
there? Okay.
And we lived there for about 4 years, and then we sold it. And we sold it for $275,000.
Hey, okay.
So we have yet to hit that ramp where you go, wow, buying a house, it always doubles in value every 4 years, right? Nope. I've now told you about two houses that either stayed roughly exactly the same or dropped in value. So keep that in mind. If you've only been looking at houses in the past 5 years, then you have a very inaccurate picture of what the real housing market is like.
Okay.
But why did we do that? Why did we sell this? It's because my wife, who I haven't really mentioned enough yet, but she is gifted. She is very gifted at this real estate selection and vision thing, where she can walk into a house that other people aren't interested in and say, I know exactly what the potential of this place is. And the truth is, if you've ever even sold a house, the realtor will go like, we have to paint this room because somebody could walk in here, and if they don't like the paint, they will walk away from a $700,000 house because they don't want to buy a $30 can of paint and repaint this bedroom.
Yes.
Most people have zero vision for what a property could look like.
You're now touching on the thing which to me is like the headline of this whole episode, which is the way that you guys shop for houses, because you, I know this about you, you defer to your wife's visionary expertise. And when she sees something that she goes, this, now this we can do something with, you shrug your shoulders and go, okay, well, I guess we should buy it. So
yeah.
To keep talking about what you notice about the way that she looks around at a house.
So if there's a house that's been renovated and everyone that walks in the front door goes, wow, this is awesome. She is uninterested. Like
that is such a skill, because we all get infatuated with the bells and whistles. And you're saying if it's a dream home and everything is perfect, she's not interested in that house. That is probably the most financially shrewd thing that will be said on this whole episode, is that you guys do not buy dream houses.
Yeah, that's true. And at least not yet. I think that there's a chance that I will buy one someday, because as we'll discuss here, we might be reaching the end of our days of camp stove in the garage for 4 months while we renovate.
Yes. But we're talking about making your house an investment. And when you guys cross the finish line of, we don't need the house to be an investment, we've got so much money, we want to move into a dream house, that's a different conversation.
Right. But yeah, that's the thing about my wife, is that we're kind of a team, because we go in with my spreadsheets and numbers, and I say, well, here's what we could afford. And when I do that math, I have zero interest or care in what the mortgage broker says they will loan me. I don't care. Just like I wouldn't ever go to a car dealer and they're like, well, you like this car? What kind of payment are you looking for? I always go like, do you think I'm a moron? I don't shop for a payment. We'll have the financing conversation later. I think, okay, if we bought this, A, what does the monthly drag on the budget look like? Most everyone listening to this that's interested in this topic is probably going to have a mortgage on a house, especially if you're kind of getting started.
Of course.
And then I like to, this is part of what makes me good at my job as a financial planner, is I like to think, how does this deal explode and ruin my life? And if I can think of ways to mitigate that, like, okay, here's how it goes bad. We lose our jobs. We get called by the Lord to move across the country. Who knows what? How do we respond to that? Is it a financial disaster? So going back to DC, I remember when we lived in DC talking to a mortgage broker, because I was seeing this crazy house price run up. And I think our household income was like, at one point in time, probably $80,000. That's how much we made. And I remember a mortgage broker telling me, we can get you into a house that costs $550,000. And I did the math and I was like, theoretically, I could make that payment. I could pay that mortgage if everything goes perfectly.
Right.
And yet it does terrible things for us. There's zero backstop risk-wise. You know, 2008 came, and if that had happened, we would have been stuck there forever. Basically, we would have not been able to go other places. There was no getting out of it. You could have bought a $550,000 house that was worth $400,000 a few years later. So I think about the numbers, and I make sure that we're only interested in very calculated risks. She thinks about, I'm looking for the ugly ducklings that nobody wants, because everything in a house can be fixed with the right amount of vision. And what happened in this case is she was kind of poking around, and she went up on the mountainside to the neighborhood where all the fancy houses were. And I think some people call it Pill Hill because it's full of doctors. It's this neighborhood in Salt Lake. And she said, so there's this house that was listed for $650,000, and they dropped it to $550,000. And it's pretty cool. And it's not been updated at all. And they have been sitting on the market for a long time. So we go look at it. long story short, she had vision for this place. It had some really appealing features. And we threw them an offer. I think we said, let's offer them $100,000 less than they're asking. And our realtor was like, no, you can't do that. It's offensive. Right. And they came back with like a counter offer, $20,000 over what we offered.
Wow.
And so we're under contract on this house. And one critical component to the process of buying a house like this is you must not get emotionally attached. Because we did the inspection and the inspector came back and he said, I have bad news. A quarter of this house is sinking down the mountainside. And the only way to fix that is to take hydraulic piers, put them 60 feet down into the earth and crank the house up. And it's going to cost you $60,000 to do that.
Oh.
And we said, okay, we didn't even have the option of doing that at the time. Remember, we're selling a house that I think we had put a 20% down payment on, but we didn't have $60,000 plus a down payment on this new house.
Yes.
So we just told the sellers, like, we're going to have to bail on this deal unless you want to fix the foundation. Well, the sellers, who were the children of deceased parents that owned this house outright, and they're just like, give us our money. We don't. They said, fine, we'll fix the foundation. So they fixed it. Again, the realtor the whole time saying, now, I don't think that we can ask for all of that. What if we ask for half of it? And we said, ask for all of it, realtor.
Of course.
And, you know, I don't think that that's just like our genius. I think the Lord was providing for us in that too, of course. But the upshot is we moved into this house that I think was probably worth $100,000 more than we paid for it on the first day we moved in. This one was interesting because I would say it was outdated, but livable. And this is another thing that we look for is I don't want a house generally that I move into and I'm like, we have to do everything just to survive in this place. Like, it's got a dangerous situation or the plumbing doesn't work or whatever. And we lived in that house. We took about $5,000 and we did an intentional sort of spruce up that we knew we were going to tear out someday. So we put a backsplash on the kitchen, like a tile backsplash that made it look nicer. And we pulled down some cabinets that were broken and just had a handyman go through and make things look decent and livable. But people were like, when they see the moving truck and stuff, they're like, so you're renovating this house? Obviously, you're renovating this house. And we said, no, we're going to live in it just like it is. And we did that for a couple of years. And then that's when we did our big old reno. And like I said before, that involved a lot of people, you know, part of the cost of a whole home reno is they move to another house, sometimes for 6 or 12 months. Not us. We said we will tiptoe around the construction. We literally cooked in the garage for several months over a camp stove. And that saved us a ton of money. And we used friends to do things that they could do. So one of my buddies was a contractor and I said, you probably can't do this for me on the normal schedule, but I'll pay you on kind of your off time to come in and work on this. I know it'll take a little longer, but the result was I did a whole kitchen renovation with custom cabinets and awesome granite countertops and new appliances and all that jazz, which would have cost a whole lot more. We did that. We renovated 3 bathrooms. We put a big double shower in the master and all that jazz. We put new flooring throughout the whole house, all of this stuff. And my total investment was about $65,000.
Wow.
That is a fairy tale now. I'll tell you, even if you did all the things I just said, I don't think there's any way you could do that for $5,000 today. Right. But at the time, it was possible. And part of what made it possible was the fact that we were kind of going slow, living through it, not trying to say, well, we need all this done in 2 months. Then somebody would have come and said, great, we can do the whole reno for $175,000. So we were patient and took time. there were some things that we also saved money on. I remember getting a quote for $5,000 to install a gas fireplace in this main fireplace in the upstairs. And I said, that seems like a lot of money, but there's this little gas line going to that fireplace, because it was an old, I had never seen this before. They had like a gas starter. So you could put wood logs in there and turn on this gas line and the gas would start your logs. And I figured out how to rework that. I bought gas logs on my own for like $500 on the internet and had them shipped. And then I told my whole family they had to leave the home for a day in case I blew the house up, and I did gas plumbing. And then we had gas logs. So $500 job, saved $4,500.
Nice.
We did stuff like that here and there. We built a big wet bar downstairs, and this is a place where I was like, I think I'm going to try my hand at this. So again, no time crunch. I demoed, I installed hardwood floor in a section of the basement. I ran electrical, I ran Romex. I didn't know how to do that before. I did some plumbing and bought IKEA cabinets. And I think the only thing I paid for was to have a countertop put in. But then when people walked downstairs, they went, wow, granite countertop wet bar that was like 30 feet long. That's awesome. And no one knew that I had done that myself. So the upshot of all of this, I would say, is that we invested, like I said, about 65 grand in this house over the time we lived there. And now we're starting to experience that hockey stick of house price appreciation. This is still pre-COVID, but we were in the house, you know, call it 550 by the time everything's done. And we sold the house for about $930,000 4 years later.
Now you're talking.
One thing I wanted to mention about this house before I go on is that beware of how your neighborhood affects prices you're getting quoted. Because I remember having this house was on the side of a mountain, sort of. So there's this big sloped lot, but we were like, we can't use it. We would like to level some of that off and make grassy yard for our kids and stuff. And I had a landscape designer come in and he's telling me all these awesome ideas he's got. And I'm like, this sounds great. This all sounds wonderful. How much? And he says, I mean, this would be probably $15,000 to $18,000. And I thought, that sounds so reasonable for everything you described. It sounds totally reasonable to me. And then he kind of looks at me funny and he goes, well, that's the charge for my design. The installation's going to cost you a couple hundred thousand. And I just said, get up and leave. Like, there's no chance, you psychopath. But the reason he even thought that was a reasonable thing to discuss with me is because he had been looking around this neighborhood where there was a ton of people with gobs of money. And
of
he thought, maybe this family would like to helicopter in old growth trees to their landscape.
Right.
No. So be aware of that. I found that that was true on almost anything. If you have a house that seems super nice, you got to work extra hard to get fair quotes on work.
Fact. So you did very, very good on house number two. That was the first time that all of your vision, planning, and effort chickens came home to roost. You finally saw the benefit of scrimping and doing stuff yourself. And so you got a huge benefit. Now, what did you do with that profit of that house?
What we did is we just started thinking we could maybe rinse and repeat this process. So we went and found another house. We had kind of grown sick of living on the side of the mountain where it could snow an inch down in the valley floor, and at this house, a foot and a half. So there was complicating factors. I used to bike to work at the time, and I didn't love having to climb a giant mountain at the end of my workday on my bicycle. So we said, well, what if we lived in a little more walkable spot, closer to kind of a downtown area? So we found a house and we thought, this one is pressing the definition of livable wreck, and maybe it's moving into just a total wreck. But we thought, no, we can live with this one for a year or two, do exactly what we did on the last one. It was the same deal where they started the price out a little higher. We did not have the ability to come under $100,000 on this one, but we did get it for $570,000. Our mortgage rate when we bought this next one, so we did take out a mortgage, even though if you're doing math, you can kind of see, well, you could have almost paid cash with the profits from that last one. But we took out a small mortgage, and the mortgage rate was 5.25%, so 5.25%. And we moved in. We were excited about this house. Again, it was a family where the father had passed away. The mother had moved kind of to an assisted living situation. And so they were just really looking to unload it. And I remember walking into the kitchen and going like, well, it's not a nice kitchen, but this is our kitchen for the next at least year until we're ready to really do a project. And we opened the kitchen cabinet and it fell off the wall. And I thought, this might be something we're going to have to address now.
Sooner than later. I just want to ring this bell one more time. Mark Parrott does not move into dream homes. He moves into opportunity homes. So he bought a house that thought, when this thing looks the way that it should look, there will be profits built into the walls of this place. So we are going to take our money and get into a space where we can start building equity value with the improvements that we make, which will make our lives better. We'll enjoy it more when we make these changes. And it will just be building in equity with every project we take on. That's pretty cool.
So day one, it became obvious. We've got to start renovations right away. We can't live a year in this thing. And we also did it with a hybrid approach. Unfortunately, the guy who had done my amazing kitchen at the last house for like nothing had passed away. So we couldn't use him. So we went and shopped contractors and we did a whole kitchen with cabinets and all that jazz for $70,000 at this
house.
I will tell you, based on what we did, those are fairy tale numbers now. I would not get any quotes from any contractor in my city to do what we did for under $200 today.
Okay.
That might sound nuts, but that's the case.
I believe. I have friends who are in construction and I believe because I know what prices have done for raw materials.
But there's other components of this house that I said, now we don't necessarily have to do top notch. Everything has to be perfect in the whole house. So there was like a hot tub room upstairs in this house, for example, is kind of wild. And I, instead of hiring the guy who was doing the kitchen to help me with that, I hired Sam the Gypsy Carpenter, who came recommended from a guy I used to ski with. And Sam and I sawzalled out that hot tub and put a new subfloor in. And now, you know, if you're watching on YouTube, I am standing dead in the middle of where there used to be a hot tub. That is my office now.
Wow, you are there. We're there. We're living the news. It's exciting.
But a lot of what we did after we did the main space, it was like, okay, now we're going into piece by piece renovation mode. So we didn't borrow money to do a big reno all at once. We said, okay, we're saving up now. Let's do the master bathroom. Now we're saving up. Let's do the kids' bathroom. Let's, at one point, you've benefited from this. We said, let's make just a great guest space. So we have a 2-bedroom guest suite now in the basement where a family can basically feel like they've got their own apartment and they don't have to be in the common space all the time.
Yes.
So we did all that. And I recently added this up. I think we spent $320,000
in improvements,
start to finish, in improvements on this house.
Okay,
that includes some stuff that was fun, like new kitchen and new master bathroom. Some stuff that was not fun, like I just put in a new concrete driveway, and I'm like, well, there it is, because the old driveway was just crumbling to bits, and it had to be replaced.
And you guys replaced all like the hardscaping on the front of the house just to like keep the wall from tumbling over.
Yes, the retaining wall was melting, so we had to fix that. Some of that stuff, not super fun. The landscaping does look nice now, but, you know, did an exterior renovation on the house to make it look nicer. And anyways, today, this house, I told you at the start, it's for sale right now.
Because my math says with your purchase and all of your reno, you're in this house for $890.
That's what my math says too.
Okay.
And this house is worth about $1.7 million today.
Whoa.
Which is crazy, but some of that is just a factor of we lived here during the COVID boom, and especially cities out west, people just fled from places like California. And those people that had owned houses there started doing crazy things with their money when it comes to housing. So that if I wanted to move out of this house, like I would love to do what we did on the last house and just say, well, let's just start over and buy another $500,000 house. And
right.
My friend bought a house in this neighborhood the other day and he paid $985,000 for it. And then a week later, he took bulldozers and knocked that house down because
holy
it was
cow.
In such unusable shape. That was the value of the lot.
Oh, my word.
And unlike my last house that was in this kind of fancy neighborhood, my neighborhood now is very mixed. There's houses that you would look at and go, I wouldn't walk by that house closely in the dark. Right? Uh-huh. And then there's houses that are super nice. So it's just one of the features of Utah that housing has really exploded in cost here. But to kind of wrap up our tale, what happened recently and the reason I'm standing in a house that's for sale is my wife, she's out there. She's always peeking around. Are there any opportunities? And she found a house that felt like, wow, this is another one that's sat on the market for a while. They can't sell it. And there is the possibility to add a ton of value to the house.
Hmm.
It might make you laugh because she's like, well, what do you think? Should we go look at it? And I said, well, go look at it. Check it out. And she came back. She said, I loved it. I could totally see this being a blessing for us. And I said, well, get it under contract. And I think you laughed at that, Stephen, when I told you, but I had never even stepped foot in that house to check it out until
that
we were
so
under
funny.
Contract to buy it. And in this case, there is a lot of moving pieces, but
I just want to say at this point, one of your options is to go back to Austin and buy three houses.
That's true.
Just with your profit. But I'm just observing.
Go back to Austin in 2005.
I know. Yes, of course. I just want to observe that like the returns on what you're doing are growing because you guys are building your skill in like thinking this way. Obviously when you can fold in profits from a previous house sale, you can do more. I had a friend in England when I lived in England who he did what you did on your last house, which is he moved into a place. He basically did everything himself and he would move into a house thinking this is a 10-year project and I'll live here. My house will get increasingly better. And when I move out, I will score big time because I can see where it is. I can see, I understand how houses work. I know the opportunities here. So you guys are kind of growing in skill and it stands to reason that that the value of the homes that you're getting into are growing as well as your profit.
Yeah. So just to kind of wrap up, we go through this new property. It is pricey and gigantic.
Okay.
And the inspection report that came back, not many things freaked me out. But there was some things on this one where I'm like, my system again of, well, let me imagine how this goes really badly. I'm like, there's some monsters lurking in the closet of this house that could be $300,000 situation.
Yeesh.
And so I'm starting to go, I don't know. And then this house, it just takes a lot longer to sell a house at this price point than it takes.
Uh-huh.
To sell. So I'm like, well, we kind of decided we're happy in this house. We don't need to move. Let's just roll the fleece out and see. And maybe if this is the Lord's will, we'll get a killer offer on this house, and then we'll continue down that street. But I again go back to, it's very, very important if you want to do well in this housing thing, you've got to be unemotional. And it right. it also separates you so much for, like, when I'm talking to realtors or whoever, I'm like, I don't care if I buy this house. The right. numbers work. It could be good. And it could be great for me to stay in my current house where I pay a mortgage that's like a third of what it would cost to rent a house in Salt Lake.
Right. Okay. So you told us that the house that you're in right now, will you think it'll go for 1.7? And what's the house that you're looking at?
It's a little bit more. It's like $50,000 more.
Okay. Wow. Awesome. Okay.
So it's a pretty much a sideways move. However, that house is the only house within a mile of it that's under 2 million.
So you're going to realize all of the equity gains that are kind of imaginary right now in the house that you live in, but you'll experience them. You get much more of a house than you're in right now. And there's a bunch of upside. You are living the highest upside of your present house. But the house that you're going into, you think if this thing is fixed up, it'll be worth more than two.
Yeah. And just to tell you what I think is going to happen, I think because of what we had to do to get that house under contract, there's a very short timeline on how long we would have to sell this house. And I don't think we're going to do it. I don't think okay. we're going to get a compelling offer. And so I think we're probably going to end up bailing on that new house opportunity. And one of the big things that my wife says about our current house is there's not a place for teenagers to just like go and have fun and hang out. That's one thing that just didn't fit. But there is this unfinished space in my house that could be that. And she's like, if this doesn't work out, could we talk about turning that space into what we want? It's totally not a financially smart move to do that, because it then puts us like head and shoulders above everything on our street in terms of
right,
value.
I got to.
And I don't care. Like, yeah. I think most likely, I don't know, I could get a crazy offer on my house this weekend, but most likely we're going to stay put. We're going to invest some money that's not pointed at getting us a financial return, but that allows my wife to create the environment that is best for our family. That's a fine use of money because we can afford to do it. But it's not how we thought 5 years ago when we were first moving in here and thinking, let's make sure our big improvements are ones that we absolutely will get paid for in the long run. So different things, different sort of metrics for making decisions. What I didn't mention is if I did sell this house for what I would need to get for it to be convinced to move, I'm going to owe a lot of taxes because you get a $500,000 exemption when you sell a house that you've lived in at least two out of the last 5 years. Meaning if you buy a house for 500 grand, you can sell it for a million, no taxes, you're good. You sell it for 1.7, and you're going to owe capital gains tax on everything above the $500,000 exemption. And that's just worth throwing out there to say, if you're in one of these crazy high cost areas and you bought your house a while ago, keep track of every improvement you've made because all of those costs add to the purchase price and reduce the potential tax that you would pay if you do sell your house and have a huge profit someday. So that's kind of where we're at now. It's really no different in terms of the way we think about housing than it was two or three houses ago. It's still like, where can we find something that others don't want that we can add value to?
Yeah.
Do you think we have time for me to give like a 2 minute little treatise on realtors before we wrap up? Because
do it. And we'll close out with it. With some realtor thoughts.
Yeah. Most people who are in this process are going to use a realtor. You don't have to, but most people will. And this is like the biggest transaction cost when you're buying and selling. If you're selling a house, you're going to, the old standard was you're going to pay 6%, 3% to your realtor and 3% to your buyer's realtor. And I remember as a kid, when we went to look at houses, the realtor like put us in her big car and drove us around to look at houses. And there was no way for us to know aside from driving around looking for signs, what was available? Well, that's not true anymore. If you're on the house hunt, like my wife always is, she knows the second a new house is listed in our city that meets her criteria, and she's checking it out. So I'm just saying that if your realtor, they're not doing what they were doing 30 years ago for you. This isn't a knock on realtors, but you know, people rag on financial planners all the time. Like, those guys, they're just sitting on your money and making 1% and not doing anything. And I actually agree with those people that if a financial planner is doing nothing for you other than managing your money using some software, then you can go do that yourself for way less money. But the solution isn't that a realtor shouldn't get paid. It's that you want them to earn their pay. So if you're selling a house and you're going to pay a commission, I think that means you're amping up the marketing of the property. You're helping, you've got a demonstrated track record of, I know how to price well and bring people in. If you're buying, I want a realtor that's going to earn 3% to bring me deals like that aren't on the market yet. And so those are the kind of questions I'm asking. And the other thing I'll say, this might upset a realtor or two that's listening,
say it. They can deal with it.
These fees, this 6% amount, it's entirely negotiable.
Yes.
And I have found people that go, well, I would love to give you a discount, but my broker won't allow it. Well, I can talk to a broker who can do it for a flat fee.
Yeah.
I've talked to people who will sell your house and list it on the MLS and do it for a flat fee of $600. Now,
right.
That may or may not be a wise choice, because what you get, again, I'm not opposed to people charging a ton of money for a premium service.
Yeah.
But if you're selling a $250,000 starter home, it actually might be totally fine to hire a photographer for $200 and
yes.
pay a realtor who can just get you on the MLS and you coordinate all the showings.
Yes.
Those types of options exist. So, you know, just be aware of what you're paying and make sure you're getting your money's worth if you're going to go through a realtor, knowing that it's, no matter what anyone says, those fees are totally and entirely negotiable.
Yes. Yep. Very good. Mark, thank you for your story. It's helpful to piggyback on what's happening to you in real time. I'm very happy that you bought a house that has ballooned in value. I hope you can realize it while we're at the crest of this value wave. And you say that you're vacating the house like within the hour for a showing?
I think they're doing an open house here.
Open house.
Yeah. My heart has already kind of sailed on the whole deal. So out of respect to the people that have spent time and money to prep this thing for sale, we kind of said, let's go ahead and let the open houses continue. But
yeah.
It's an interesting spot, because I think normally I'd be like, well, it's no big deal. You're going to take a few months on the market. This time I'm like, Lord, either you bring me full price or better offer in the next 5 days, or
yeah.
I am totally unemotionally canceling my plans.
Good stuff. Improvement, money for value. Refi when you can. You guys have done great on the home front, and I hope this next thing works out for you. We'll look forward to hearing the update on it. We'll see you later.